All right, so we've been talking about the spirit of the age this quarter, and especially talking about that in terms of a lot of ideologies that run rampant in our time. I've been suggesting that our real root ideas of materialism that has led to a de facto atheism in how we think and act. And again, part of our, what I've been emphasizing is how much this gets into us as Christians and in the church if we're not careful, more than we realize. And so even materialistic assumptions get into us and lead to a practical atheism. We talked about the scientism of our culture, and that makes sense in one sense in terms of the culture. If all there is material reality, the unseen is not real, there is no unseen reality, then science is the only way to truth, and that's very much a world that we live in to a point. We talked about utilitarianism, which is a fancy word for the idea that just whatever works, whatever makes people happy, that's kind of the definition of what's right or good in an otherwise atheistic, materialistic culture. I mean, you got to have some moral standard, and so whatever's good for the most. Of course, we talked about the logical contradiction there, right? Because who gets to define what good or happy is in that context? And thus, the more we as a culture have fallen into using that as a standard, absorbed unconsciously in many of us, that's why we're fighting more and more with each other, because there's no standard, there's no way of defining what makes us happy. Different people find different things happy, and so we talked about that a little bit. And then all of these, we talked about some Bible passages that kind of balance it out. There's nothing new under the sun. What is new about our time is the extremeness and intensity of which we are practicing some of these things, or embracing some of these things, or pursuing them far further down towards their catastrophic logical ends than other cultures have done. That's what's new, is how far we are pushing things compared to other cultures. I want to talk tonight about relativism, one of the other upshots. If all there is to reality is materialism, what you see is what you get, can there be anything called truth?
No.
Well, yeah, at least in our culture, the general answer is no.
Which is ironic, because scientific principle is absolute.
Yeah.
Physics is absolute.
Right.
So if we're relying on science to describe and determine everything, there should be some.
Sure.
You think.
Well, you would think. And so here's, and Scott's already put his finger immediately on one issue, which is, and we see this with all these, and again, hopefully you'll see some of this with all of these, because that's why you're here as a Christian in the church and sane, because you see the inherent contradictions, one of which is, for people who say there is no truth, they generally still believe in science, and you're right, scientific laws or whatnot. But part of where relativism, even for the materialistic atheist, still kicks in is, even if they want to maintain some sort of limited truth, law of gravity kind of stuff, that still can't tell us how to live. That still can't tell us how to organize a society. Remember back earlier in the quarter, we talked about the big questions that you got to have answers for, right? And so one of them is, how should we live together? How do you organize society? And the function of that is what's right and what's wrong, what's just, what's fair. And so there's no answer for that if all there is material reality. There's no way to answer that. And so there is certainly an internal contradiction there, because even the idea of saying, there is no such thing as truth, what's the best way to talk, what's the best way to refute somebody in that right then and there? Ask them, how do you know that's true? Because they stated it as a truth. Think about it. When somebody says there's no such thing as truth, what are they implying about that statement? That statement is?
True.
And so all you got to do, literally, you got somebody who's messing with your relatives, just ask them, how do you know that's true? And go to lunch. Because they watch their head explode. But seriously. But nonetheless, we live this way in our culture all the time. How does it come out? It doesn't always just come out with people literally saying, I don't believe in objective truth, or I don't believe there's such a thing as truth. It comes out when people say, let's just agree to disagree. What's implied in that statement?
Yeah,
another form of that same dynamic is people start talking about, that's my truth and this is your truth. Hear people talk that way? Get more personal. You ever talk that way? Has that crept into your vocabulary? your way of thinking about things? Subtly, because it does. I mean, I've heard Christians talk that way. It scares me when it does, because what it tells me is they don't realize what's seeping into them from the culture. When they start talking about my truth and your truth. That's a dangerous thing. Because what's really implying is there is no such thing as truth. And so people who are relativists, and again, you know, yes, we've already put our finger on lots of logical contradictions, but people really aren't rational in how they live and how they choose to live. I mean, that's part of the other thing that you got to learn to accept real fast when it comes to humanity and people as groups and in general. And so the reality is, you want to know why it seems like everybody just follows the crowd these days? I mean, people have always been crowd followers, but why are people so vulnerable to, say, media and social media manipulation? Why are people chasing the latest headline or peer pressure or whatever emotional mood they woke up in this morning? It's because they really don't believe there's some sort of truth to organize their life around, some sort of objective truth. And so that's part of the danger here. There have always been people like that to a point. I think about Ephesians chapter 4. It's an interesting, you know, it's a passage that I think a number of us are kind of familiar with. But when we look for Scripture's words and scriptural ways of diagnosing what we see around us, go back to a familiar, well, at least part of this is familiar, maybe not all of it, or maybe thinking through the whole context is not familiar. I think a couple of these verses will be familiar enough, but the whole context. Ephesians chapter 4, I'm going to pick up reading in verse 7. And part of what Paul is describing here is, I think, the ascension of Jesus from heaven's perspective. In other words, you know, we saw the ascension of Jesus in the book of Acts from the earthly perspective, right? They're out there on the mountain, and all of a sudden Jesus goes up, and the disciples are caught standing slack-jawed, staring in the sky, and the angels say, "Why are you guys looking at the sky?" You know, he'll come back the way he left. And that's what, you know, for most of the ascension, that's the scene we think of. But what did it look like from heaven's perspective? That's part of what's going on in Ephesians chapter 4. And so, verse 7, Ephesians 4 and verse 7, but grace was given to each one of us. And grace there, that word is so wrecked by the religious world. Verse 7, but grace was given to each one of us according to the measure of Christ's gift. And the word for grace and gift are essentially the same basic root. And the idea here is that Christ's grace, his favor, is shown in the gifts he hands out. Now, a lot of times in the New Testament, we start hearing about gifts. You think of what? You think of spiritual gifts. You think of, you know, these miraculous manifestations. Part of the reason we get so messed around, again, the religious world has made such a mess of things, is that in the New Testament, Christ and the Spirit's gifts go beyond just those miraculous manifestations that were limited to the apostolic era. And so what he says here, well, let me read a little bit more. Therefore, it says, he quotes a psalm, when he ascended on high, he led a host of captives and he gave gifts to men. And saying he ascended, what does it mean that, but that he ascended first in the lower regions of the earth? And so he who ascended is the one who also ascended far above all heavens that he might fill all things. So it just reminds us that the one who was ascended was the one who descended to earth first, accomplished his work, and went back. All of this is a fancy way to say what Jesus does when he ascends back into heaven is, and Paul uses the imagery of the way it worked in Rome, in the Roman world. When a Roman general would come back from a victorious campaign, and we forget sometimes part of what the New Testament depicts, Jesus' incarnation and return is he came to make war on the devil. He came to reclaim lost territory to sin and the devil, right? That's one of those, it's often forgotten, but it's one of the New Testament images. He was the one who came to destroy the works of Satan and to reclaim his kingdom. And so he's like a Roman, you know, and this imagery that Paul's tapping into here, it's a little hard to catch, but what he's tapping into is a Roman general would go, he would conquer, and he would return back to Rome, and there'd be a parade, there'd be a celebration. In fact, to this day, what's one of the most famous sites or that still remains from ancient Rome and 2,000 years ago, it's Titus's triumphal arch. And what's depicted on that arch? Anybody know or remember? What's depicted on that arch?
The destruction of Jerusalem.
the destruction of Jerusalem. And in particular, what's depicted is the carrying of all the loot from the Jerusalem temple. When Titus comes back to Rome, and they parade it through the streets of Rome, and part of what returned jewels do, they throw gold, and they spread the wealth, literally, as everybody kind of waves palm branches, or, cheers, and, think of, closest thing we've got to it today is a Super Bowl victory parade, which is something Houston wouldn't know about. But, I'm sorry, that was ugly. It makes you feel any better if Dallas is forgotten. I'm sorry. Anyways. But the closest thing to that is like a sport, one of our major sports teams' victory parades, right? What happens? You go to some other city, play the Super Bowl, wherever it was set that year, and you go back home to Kansas City, where it's been happening way too much lately, and what do? They get on the fire engine, they go, and everybody's cheering, and of course, the only thing that makes it nice when it happens in Kansas City is they have to do it in February in the cold. But anyways, but that's what they do. Well, and people have said that, closely we've got to Warriors and Gladiators today is football players beating the daylights out of each other on a football field. Maybe there's some truth to that because we certainly parade them around when they win. That's closest analogy, except that they don't throw any of their paychecks to us. but anyways, so Jesus goes back to heaven, the conquering hero who has come to earth, defeated Satan, reclaimed, reestablished a kingdom, right? Was a big part of that. And as he goes back, he leads a host of captives. It's kind of Satan and the demonic. The idea is they're defeated. And he gives gifts to men. That's what returning conquering heroes do. Only what does he give? What are his gifts? Verse 11. The verse is just, we don't catch it in context. What does the returning victorious Christ in heaven give as gifts to his people still stuck on earth? And it's not just spiritual miraculous gifts. He gives roles. He gives people, types of people, as gifts to his church to enjoy the life that he has made possible. And so thus come the apostles and the prophets and the evangelists, the shepherds or elders or pastors, depending on your translation, the teachers. And they were given as gifts. Why? So that God's people can be what they need to be, to equip the saints for the work of ministry, for the building up of the body of Christ, until we all attain to the unity of the faith and of the knowledge of the Son of God, to maturity, to mature manhood, to the measure of the stature of the fullness of Christ. Here's why we came to this passage tonight, though, verse 14. So that we may no longer be children tossed to and fro by the waves and carried about by every wind of doctrine, by human cunning, by craftiness and deceitful schemes. But rather speaking the, and here's this contrast, that's why the word rather or but, depending on your translation of verse 15 is there. The contrast is speaking the what?
True truth.
Oh, there's the contrast. What is truth contrasting with in verse 14?
Trickery of man, craftiness.
Yeah, there's actually several phrases you could pick in verse 14. Paul wants to underscore. One is human cunning, craftiness and deceitful schemes. What's the image or the metaphor he uses?
Tossed about like a ship on the...
Yeah, people who are just blown about on a choppy sea. I grew up in Florida, and I remember part of the daily local weather forecast. Growing up in Tampa, they talk about rain, they talk about temperature, humidity, but they'd also talk about the how high the seas were. Because people like to go out in the bay, people like to go out boating in the Gulf. And so part of our weather report was always how high the waves were. A little bit more wind tonight, there'll be a 3-foot chop, and so the point is if you got a smaller boat, you might not want to be out in that. You got something a little bit bigger because, there are a lot of New Yorkers who come down to Tampa to die, and they bring their money with them, and they've got a little bit nicer boats, and they don't mind 3 to 4 foot waves, but if it gets to 6 to 8, well, then they might want to stay in tonight, So that's what waves do. If you're not used to Gulf life or coast life, you don't think a 3-foot wave is much until you try to swim it. You find out that even a 3-foot swell will really wear you out in a hurry, which is why people who aren't used to beaches accidentally drown, because they overestimate even with a seemingly small wave. And so that's a really apt metaphor that Paul picks in for people who don't know the truth. They're just blown about every which way. Does that sound like people you know right now?
Sure.
What's a mark of people who are infected with relativism even if they don't know it? Is that they
follow the crowd.
They follow the crowd. You know somebody who's always coming up with some new thing, they've read some new book, they've found some new podcast, they're watching some new YouTube series, some document, you know, somebody like that. Not all of us can be medical experts or scientific experts, but part of it is we are a culture in which, because we are collectively an extremely relativistic culture, truth is dead in our culture. And that's part of why even anymore we can't always even agree upon what's scientific truth. Even they said there's what's objective reality. Well, yeah, but there's always an element of interpretation. And if you doubt that, just look at the big COVID fight we just had. And I'm not trying to reopen that can of worms. My point is, why did so many people see it so many different ways? Well, because some people are stubborn, Jeff. Well, yeah, but technically, there was a lot of fighting, among politicians and those who had access to information. A lot of fighting among scientists in some cases. Some voices just didn't get heard. That's the culture we live in. We fight about this stuff all the time. We have become a culture that's blown about far more than we realize.
Have you heard about Massachusetts? They are refusing to allow people to adopt children unless they believe, and this is not my, they're worrying, this is my worry, they believe in LGBT.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, they're not the only states. There are several states that have gone down that road where there are some states, Washington most notoriously, that have passed laws now that as a parent, if your child decides it wants to, he or she wants to transition or whatnot, and you don't support the child, then that the state will take the child. So your rights as a parent over major medical health care decisions in your kid, and even in psychological health care, mental health care decisions for your kid. If your kid decides he or she wants to transition medically, your 15-year-old daughter decides she wants to replumb her body, and you don't support it, or allow it, the state can take the child away.
And that's part of this thing in Massachusetts.
Yeah, it's a mess. Jana, you had a hand?
It's interesting that you said that about truth, because there's this lady that's a Jehovah's Witness, and she's been coming to my door.
Yeah.
And she asked me a question today, where does truth come from? And I said, she said, do you believe in truth? And I said, yes. And she said, where does it come from? And I said, God.
Yeah.
And I'm like thinking, I don't believe in your truth, though.
Right.
So how do you, we're talking about kind of like people that are worldly that don't have a truth. But what if somebody thinks their truth is not your truth?
That's a fair question, but that's downstream. I want to punt on that if I can, because, But actually, you do segue that, again, I still want to experiment a little bit with, examining ourselves and seeing if we're more relativistic than even we realize. And so again, think about things that either we say or things that make us uncomfortable when either someone else says them, or if it makes you uncomfortable if I say it right now, or if you were asked to say it. Like, for instance, are you uncomfortable, and Jan just hinted at this a little bit actually, but are you uncomfortable saying other denominations are wrong? It depends. Yeah, I know a lot of younger Christians more and more who are uncomfortable saying the Baptists are wrong or the Methodists are wrong. Maybe you're uncomfortable right now because I said that. And yet, can their view of the church, our view of the church, and the Baptist view of the church all be correct?
Yeah.
No, they can't be. And so when we begin to just kind of whitewash that, what are we actually practicing? We're practicing a form of? There's only one thing that can be true. We can't all be right. Especially in our political culture. Do we get nervous? Do we get uncomfortable saying Islam is wrong?
Now you can get your head cut off.
Well, saying Orthodox Jews are wrong. I heard that. there's one in every crowd. but think about it. If we're not prepared to say that, and I'm not talking about being ugly, being malicious, being obnoxious, but the fact that we even can't say that without what? Either cringing or caveats or whatever. Why? Look, can the Jews, the Muslims, and the Christians all be right?
No.
And if we want to whitewash over that, what are we practicing? We're practicing just what we talked about, materialism leads to atheism, whether you want to admit it or not, and we're more atheist than we realize. when we get uncomfortable, our culture is acculturating us to this, folks, more and more especially those of us who are younger. We can't all be right. And if we want to whitewash or sweep it under the rug or whatever, what are we practicing? We're practicing a form of? Yes, ma'am.
Yeah, I had a coworker that got very upset with me, years back and said, you're going to see. You'll see that there's more than one way to get into heaven.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely.
When you get there, you'll see there's different ways.
Yeah. And see, that itself is a relativistic statement, right? There's more than one way to, or all roads lead to, or whatever. Those are all relativistic statements. And of course, in our culture, stop and think about it too. Part of why people get angry is number one, it's personal, but think about this angle too. Have you heard of this angle? Because it's certainly out there in academia, it's there in the media, it's there in all sorts of places if you look or listen. But what relativistic thinking does is it blames all manner of war and revolution and political chaos in history over people fighting over their certainty that they're right. And so whether it's the wars of religion in Europe, or things like that. And so the way to solve all this violent conflict is what? There really is no truth. There's no truth. There's nothing worth fighting over. And so if we would just simply give up on this dogmatic view that there's objective truth or absolute truth, what can we have? We could have?
Peace. Much truth.
Yeah, a bunch of truth, but there'd be nothing worth fighting over, and so we'd have peace. And yet the irony is, in one of the most relativistic cultures in human history, how's it look out there right now? Are we a peaceful people?
No.
No, because why ancient tyrants, even if they didn't personally believe, why they insisted on worshiping a certain way or a state religion or other things? Because even ancient tyrants, even heretics, understood you can't have a society with no shared common beliefs about ultimate values. That doesn't lead to peace, that just leads to more chaos of a different sort, and for a different reason, but at least just as much or more chaos, such as the miserable human lot. But certainly, those who insist that there is absolute truth, let alone that they know it, are blamed as the troublemakers in our culture. And so here's part of where, again, we wonder, maybe if we become more relativistic than we realize. And again, I'm not talking about being ugly, obnoxious. I'm not talking about saying things just for the sake of getting a rise out of people, because there are people who like to say obnoxious things just to aggravate people. There are people who like to argue and debate. But when push comes to shove and we're asked to, say what we believe is true, you understand that this is exactly why people hated Jesus. And people came to hate the apostles, and people became to hate the Christians. They didn't hate Jesus because he fed multitudes and he healed sick people. Why did they hate Jesus? Because he said, I am the way, the truth, and the life, and what?
No one comes to the Father.
And so when you hold on to absolute truth in any age or era, you're going to get conflict. And Jesus warned his followers what? In the world, you will have what?
Tribulation.
Why are we going to have tribulation if being a Christian is just about doing nice things for people and being kind and generous? And why would he say that?
They will hate you because they hated me.
They hated me, and they didn't hate him because he fed, he fed the hungry and healed the sick. Why did they hate him? Because he said, "I am truth." And when Jesus said to his would-be followers, "Blessed are you when all men hate you for my sake," why are they going to hate us? Not because we're doing nice things for our neighbors when they're sick and got cancer. Why are they going to hate us? And maybe one of the reasons that we are not more hated already is because we are more relativistic in our own words and actions than we want to admit.
He also didn't fit the part physically.
Oh, no.
And they see. You dare say that you're a king and you look like that?
Yeah. No, that was part of the point was, God reverses all human standards and expectations. By the way, Jesus wasn't the first king of God. David started that way too. the least of Jesse's sons turns out to be the guy. Even the prophet Samuel got sucked in on looking at the tall, good-looking guys. But do you understand what I'm getting at? Do you see that? You see the problem, the challenge we're facing? They didn't hate the Christians in the early even in the early centuries. You know, Rome was actually remarkably tolerant of religions. That's why they had this thing called the Pantheon, which you can still also, along with Titus's Arch, you can go to Rome to this day and see the Pantheon. And ironically, it's in Rome where they spoke Latin, and Pantheon is a Greek phrase or word. Anyone know what Pantheon means, though?
All gods.
All gods, yeah. What was the purpose of the Pantheon in ancient Rome?
To worship all gods.
Yeah, everybody we conquer, because that was the thing, was just everybody could, it was an ancient version of religious relativism. All roads go to the same place. And then what do the Christians come along and say?
No.
No. And by the way, the Jews were monotheists as well. Why did the Romans leave the Jews alone about this, interestingly? Anybody know? Just as a sidebar? They destroyed the Jews not because of their religion. They destroyed the Jews because they kept revolting, though for the Jews that was a religious reason to revolt. But that was why they destroyed the Jews, because they got tired of the revolts. But they left the Jews alone religiously because the Jews weren't evangelistic. The Jews were not interested. You know, but think about it. You know, even though, you know, think about Pharisaism. You know, they were insular, man. They were better than you, and you could burn in hell. They had no interest in reaching out to Gentiles. In fact, that's one of the early struggles in the early church, right? Was Jewish Christians struggling to accept the fact that we're evangelistic towards these God-forsaken Gentiles. So anyways, yeah, so the Jews even and the Romans had no problem because the Jews mostly stayed in their lane except for those constant revolts in Palestine. What was the problem with the Christians? Christians kept on going around and saying what? Jesus is Lord and there is none other. And that's what led to massive conflict. That's where the problems came. And so, in one sense, this is one of the most basic places where the rubber meets the road, first century or 21st century. We are not a Christian nation. This is not a Judeo-Christian culture anymore. And if you speak the truth that Jesus himself died for, you're going to find yourself more and more in conflict with people. And again, I'm not talking about going out being obnoxious. You know, we're not jerks for Jesus. I've unfortunately known, especially usually younger people, not to pick on anybody in here. I don't think anybody here would do it. But I've known younger people who like to argue. They kind of get a little thrill out of, you know, showing people they're wrong. You know, so that's not the purest of motives when you do this. But when we're asked to tell what we believe and why, you know, when we've got that religious friend or coworker who wants to tell us that it's all the same, or we can agree to disagree, or, you know, whatever. And agree to disagree is fun as a disengagement strategy, but it's not true. I mean, literally, yes, you can agree to disagree, but emphasis is not on the agreement. Emphasis is on the we disagree. We disagree. And so, you know, you think about it. Part of what has made Christianity controversial in every culture is because it says there is only one way and there is only one truth. It has passages like Luke chapter 13, where as Jesus was going on his way through towns and villages, Luke 13 verse 22, he was on his way through towns and villages, teaching and journeying toward Jerusalem, and someone said to him, Lord, will those who are saved be few? Oh man, someone just finally got to let's get to the heart of it. Let's let the rubber meet the road here. You know, everything else aside, let's just get down to brass tacks. How many are going to make it? And he said to them, strive to enter through the narrow door, for many, I tell you, will seek to enter and will not be able. And when once the master of the house has risen and shut the door, and you begin to stand outside and knock at the door, saying, Lord, open to us, then he will answer and say, I don't know where you've come from. And then you will begin to say, we ate and drank in your presence. You taught in our streets. And he will say, I tell you, I do not know where you come from. Depart from me, all you workers of evil. And in that place there will be weeping and gnashing of teeth when you see Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and all the prophets in the kingdom of God, but you yourselves are cast out. And people will come from east and west and north and south and recline at the table in the kingdom of God. And behold, some are last who will be first, and some are first who will be last. So when Jesus is asked, Lord, are there just a few who are being saved? What's his basic answer?
Yes.
Yeah.
I'm sure you're one of them.
And we're all of them to be everybody. If I understood your question, ask the question again.
Well, Lord, are there just a few who will be saved?
And
his answer is
yes.
Yeah.
Make sure you're one of them.
Make sure you're one of them because the door is
narrow.
Matthew chapter 7. This is a similar teaching, different context, but far more familiar with. Enter by the narrow gate. For the gate is wide and the way is easy that leads to destruction, and those who enter by it are many. For the gate is narrow and the way is hard that leads to life. And those who find it are few.
You know, people don't look at the destructions that God presented or caused to happen. The flood, there was more than that destruction. I don't know, just can't remember which ones they are, but the destructions, there was 4 or 8 in the ship. And
however many you were off, yeah.
How many in the...
Yeah. I know. Or to drive the point even home more, you know, over the course of the Gospels, Jesus has multitudes at some points following him, multitudes. So large a crowd that he gets the attention of the authorities. You know, winds up on the FBI's radar, we'd say today. And yet, after his death and resurrection, you know how many were in the upper room after the ascension when they were waiting for the day of Pentecost? Anybody remember? 120. You realize that's a fraction of what we have in this congregation on a Sunday morning. But after 3 years of Jesus' ministry, after the greatest act of divine mercy that will ever be offered, after the greatest miracle in human history, how many? 120. Yeah. So that's the thing. It's you know, we get a little uncomfortable. Part of it's uncomfortable is because we realize we need to be more critical and self-examining of ourselves, perhaps, in this. But part of why this makes us uncomfortable is who wants to be the first one to tell your Baptist neighbor next time y'all start talking about religion and they ask something that kind of, you know, the right answer for you to say is something along this line. Who wants to be the one to do that? Yeah, we don't want to do that. But that's the truth. Boy, the power of relativism, of avoiding these hard conversations. Craig.
Man I worked with for many years, got cancer, passed away a couple weeks ago.
Okay.
Mormon.
Yeah.
And I went to see him, and making me really reflect, I mean, that was not necessarily the time to have this discussion.
Well, that's right, yeah.
But
that's right.
He used the word truth probably 4 times in our hour and a half conversation. You know, our truth says this.
Yeah.
And really, I should have probably said something to him.
Yeah.
He's laying there in the hospital bed. And all.
Yeah.
That was kind of tough. But
it's funny though.
His truth is way different than our truth.
It is. But you know what's funny about that though? On the flip side, one of the things that I have noticed in general, you mentioned he's a Mormon. The Mormons as a whole, and I'm speaking stereotypically right now, admittedly, but in my experience, the Mormons as a whole do a far better job being unapologetic about who and what they are.
Yes.
And letting the chips fall where they may.
Right. That's true.
That's sobering.
There's no doubt. I mean, we worked together 30 years ago.
He
was very devout.
Yeah.
And from the first time I met him, he's never wavered in that dialogue.
Yeah.
Never.
And part of it is just even going back to how they raise their young people. Listen, you know what they do with their high school kids?
Send them out on ministry.
Well, no, that's later. That's later. During their high school years, 4 years all through high school, they call it seminary. And what it is it's either at 5 or 5:30 every morning before they go to school.
Right.
They meet at their local building for an hour of religious instruction 5 days a week, all 4 years of high school.
Yep.
Let's just be honest. If we were to do that here,
your kids would be the only ones to show up.
If I could show up. I am not a Mormon, but that's the thing. But what are they doing from the time they are young? They are organized. Well, it's truth, but the reason what they're doing is that they believe they have the truth.
Right.
And they're willing to sacrifice and suffer for their truth. And I don't mean that the relevance of the way, but but they will organize their lives in all sorts of ways. Let's just be honest, we're not willing to. Starting with, because you know how most high school kids can't drive you. You know how the kids 5 mornings a week that early are getting to their building? Because mom or dad is getting up and driving them there. And by the way, you know what? The kids learn as much from mom and dad as they are from whoever's teaching their seminary class. What's kid learning from mom and dad's example?
It's an important point.
This is what matters. Because I'm going to get up as early as you are to drive you here and then sit there and get you to school. And then I still got to go to work or whatever my day falls to.
In the funeral service, I went to it. Mm-hmm. In the funeral service, to your point, all four of his kids spoke. And at least two of them probably spoke to that.
Absolutely. Yeah.
About how appreciative they were that their father instill that discipline in them.
Absolutely.
To be faithful.
Absolutely. They are so much more intentional, to be honest, about almost every aspect of their religious lives.
But they're faithful to a man.
Yep. That's the tragedy. I remember years ago I was speaking actually on a college, or it was actually a university campus on the canon. I invited to come speak by a student group there on the subject of the canon. And so I had done my song and my dance about how the New Testament canon came to be. And somebody asked me, well, what about the Book of Mormon? I did a Q&A. And somebody asked, what about the Book of Mormon? And I said, well, if you understand the logic that I just laid out of how the New Testament canon came to be and what makes for a canonical book, just by its very definition, the Book of Mormon cannot be, because the New Testament canon is self-referential. And by the standards it sets, once you again, it's all in the hidden the verses we don't like to read because we think they're irrelevant. We just want to be told we'll get to go to heaven. We skip a lot of key verses that teach the logic of the canon from the apostles' own pens. Once you understand that, by definition, the Book of Mormon, I know we usually like to prove text Galatians 1, and that's fine. But even beyond that, if you just want the logic of why these books, the Book of Mormon can never, any way, shape, or form, literally my answer was just it's written in the 19th century. By the logic of the canon, it can't be. So that's the tragedy of it. It's easily refuted from that standpoint. But yeah. It's heartbreaking. It's heartbreaking. So let's do this. A couple of things. The clock's out. How much time do we have left? I don't even.
Two minutes.
Well, really, that's it. Every week. Okay, nuts. Okay, let me make two observations. Let me streamline this really quick if I got 2 minutes, because I'm getting a reputation for getting out of here late. Two things to wrap up then for tonight. When you have a society that either explicitly, as some will say, there is no such thing as truth, or just by default, again, a lot of people don't tend to be atheists, but they are de facto atheists by the way they live, the choices they make, even if they say they believe in God, because the materialism of the culture gets into them so deeply. We live in a relativistic culture that collectively does not believe in absolute truth. For that culture, the only thing that's left if you don't believe in truth are lies, by definition. Your truth, my truth, okay, that's fine. But ultimately, if I have my truth and you have your truth, how do we report the news? And that's why half this nation has one network and other half this nation has another network. Because, and I hate to be anybody's, bursting the bubble, but you realize neither side's got it all right. Everybody is selecting the information they want and leaving out the other, and a half truth, but calculated to deceive, is still a whole lie. And so here we are doing that. So understand that's part of what you're seeing going on around you is the fruits of a relativistic culture. Let me give you one. Was that the second bell already?
Yes. Yeah.
That was not 30 seconds.
No, they missed the third.
Okay, we'll be done. See you next week.
The Lamb seated.